This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. It is 11 a.m. Saturday, March 16th, and this is Kenai Garden Talk, all about growing, raising, and producing your own food on the Central Kenai Peninsula. I'm Jenny Nyman. Thanks for tuning in. On the calendar, spring officially begins March 21st. In reality, we've got a while yet before anyone in South Central Alaska is digging in the dirt, but that does not stop intrepid growers from jump-starting the season. On March 2nd, the Central Peninsula Garden Club held its annual Get Ready for Spring Roundtables event at Peninsula Grace Brethren Church on Kalifornsky Beach Road in Soldotna.
Well, I'm Phyllis Buskowski, and I'm the new president of the Central Peninsula Garden Club. And today we had roundtable discussions. We call it the Getting Ready for Spring. And so we had different people here talking about growing garlic, seed starting, high tunnels, fermenting, just about everything from A to Z for beginning gardening. So we've had a lot of people coming through and learning, and we even had a kids' table this year where they made barley buddies.
And how was the turnout? Are you pretty happy with
it? Yes, we were very happy with it. It was a steady influx of people. We had good crowds around each table learning, and people just moved from table to table learning. So we were very happy.
And what else is coming up for the Garden Club?
Well, we are going to be going to the home show. We'll be there, and that's in April. In June, we'll have our plant sale that we always do. And then we have a program coming up in this month. Our program is going to be on seeds, collecting seeds, storing them. How do you take care of those? And we're not sure yet who we're going to have in April, because we had someone scheduled and at the last minute they were not able to come.
So,
but we will have a good show, I'm sure, a good program. So we're looking forward to anybody from the public coming. They don't have to be a member to come to the meetings, but we welcome anybody and we'd love to share information. We also have a lot of garden tours during the summer, and you have to be a member of the club to go to the garden tours. We have the programs every month. And we don't meet during the May, June, July, those months, because people are busy gardening then. But we do a lot of the garden tours during that time. And we also are going to be doing what used to be our May programs. We had programs every weekend in May. We're spreading those out now, so it's going to be once a month, but we are going to present like three or four different subjects, and people can go from one to the other on one Saturday a month, different things on gardening, anything. And if people have things they want to learn about, just let us know, and we'll try to find a speaker that can talk to us about that.
Okay, so great. Anything else you'd like to say about the event today?
No, it just wasn't long enough. We learned a lot, though. So,
thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We are going to visit a couple of those stations. First up is the Alaska Authority on Growing Garlic, who happens to live on the Kenai Peninsula and also happens to be a good sport about bad vampire jokes.
I'm Lori Jenkins, and my husband and I started Synergy Gardens in east of Homer, Alaska. We started the Alaska Garlic Project, and that project is where I'm growing 12 different varieties and saving seed for other Alaskan growers, so they don't have to import their garlic seed from the lower 48, which is not climatized for our Alaskan latitudes.
What got you into garlic in the first place? I mean, of all the things you could specialize in, why garlic?
Well, I'm a foodie. I'm a garden chef, and I put garlic. I love salads and salad dressings, and garlic is culinary, it's also medicinal, and it stores well. And when I came to Alaska, I had found no one's growing garlic on a large scale, and I think it's a great crop for Alaska. We want to store it. It doesn't take any sophisticated storage equipment. It doesn't even want a root cellar. You don't have to freeze it or can it, and so it's easy to store. And so delicious and medicinal.
So there are different types of garlic, obviously. What type should folks be looking for if they want to grow their own up here?
Well, when I first started my research on growing garlic in Alaska, almost all of the old-timey books say you need to grow a hardneck, which is, there's two main strains, your hardneck and your softneck. Almost all of the garlic we're used to eating from a store are softneck garlics, and they're smaller cloves, and they store very well. But a hardneck garlic, which they recommend for Alaska, is more gourmet, larger cloves, and this seed stalk makes a thing called a garlic scape, which is so delicious. But I'm from North Georgia, and I was used to growing softneck garlic, where the necks are soft and braidable. So I trialed both varieties, and of those two strains, I've got about 14 different varieties, but I have 12 that I think are my tried and true strains that I grow for other people's seed. And they're half soft necks and half hard necks.
I've seen around here more the hard neck variety then. Garlic scape pesto is a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Yes, because every hard neck garlic is gonna make a scape. And you wanna harvest that scape, and then the energy will go back into your bulb in the ground. That scape would become a seed stalk. And it would be a beautiful little allium, a lot like a chive blossom. And you really want your energy to go back into your bulb. So you harvest that scape, and it's soft and juicy, about big as round as your pinky, a pencil or a pinky.
So once you have selected what kind you're going to try and grow, what do you do with it then? Is this like a high tunnel plant? Is it good outdoors?
Garlic grows great outdoors, and you plant it in Alaska in September or October. The goal is to get, you hope, about 6 inches of root growth before the ground freezes solid. So mid-September, late September, plant your garlic, and you plant each individual clove about four inches deep in very good enriched soil. I grow all organically, so I would recommend a farmer or a gardener fertilize their soil before they plant their garlic with compost and fishbone meal and blood meal. And if your soil is acidic, add a little lime when you plant it. And you cover it up and mulch. In Alaska, I recommend you mulch a good 12-inch layer. Some home gardeners will even mulch and then cover their garlic beds with cardboard to keep out some of the extra moisture from the snow. And then as soon as it thaws, start removing the cardboard or removing your hay mulch so that the warm sun in May will warm up the soil and your garlic should poke right through.
Nice. And what do you recommend for mulch?
I try to get good hay that doesn't have weed seed in it. And I fluff it up and mulch real thick.
And so in the spring, when it pokes its little head above the soil, what do you need to do with it at that point? Does it need to be fertilized again? Does it need to be watered real often? What does it need to be healthy?
Well, at Synergy Gardens and the Alaska Garlic Project, I plant using what I call best practices because I'm trying to be an exemplary garlic grower and sell the very best for my customers. And so I fertilize in the early spring 3 times every 2 weeks. And then I stop fertilizing like the whole month of July, and I stop watering and allow the bulb just to develop from there. And I will make fish emulsion fertilizer. I will side dress with blood meal and then do another liquid fish emulsion fertilizer after that. And I try to really hard to keep my garlic weed free so that all of the nutrients in the soil go into my garlic, not into healthy weeds.
That is a challenge for, I think, all gardeners, no matter what they're growing. Okay, should this be in direct sunlight? Is it better in cool areas? Where in the garden should someone plant garlic?
It loves direct sunlight. It will tolerate some shade, but it loves sunlight. It's considered a heavy feeder, like a vegetable, just like growing broccoli. A lot of people, you know, by the end of September, those gardeners are, you know, tired, cold, and they just want to get in their last onions, and they're, you know, ready to just be in the kitchen using all this food that they grow. But give it one more rally and plant your garlic, and then in the spring, it's easy to tend garlic because you're busy with all the other planting, and your garlic's already there.
are pests an issue at all? So this is a under the dirt plant, so moose are probably not getting to it, but are like root maggots or anything like that a concern?
I haven't had root maggots attack garlic. Slugs have not attacked garlic. There could be potential problems with nematodes or some cutworms or other pests. But if you have healthy soil and rotate your crops, like I won't plant garlic in the same spot year after year. I have different fields and different sizes, so I rotate my garlic around. And that is one of the best ways for good pest prevention, is you're not exhausting that particular soil with the same crop over and over.
Yeah, I guess if it keeps vampires away, then maybe it's good at protecting itself against pests.
That's a good way to look at it. You don't want vampires laying their eggs in your garden.
Are there any other things that folks should be aware of or mistakes to avoid or anything else you've learned that would be useful if they're going to try this?
It's also important to start with good quality seed. If you buy garlic in a grocery store and you plant it, you can do that. I wouldn't suggest it because you don't know what variety that is. You don't know how old it is. You don't know if that garlic has already been treated with bleach and so that it's clean and white. It's always good to know your strain and then you know its properties. So I would suggest you start with really high quality seed to begin with. I'm growing my own seed every year and I sell seed to other growers. And so it's indefinite. It's garlic has been cultivated over 2,000 years. And so you can save your own seed yourself. And I suggest if you want to do that, that's another reason to know what strain you're planting. But you select your biggest and your best and you replant that. As you cure and dry it, at that point, before you eat the biggest and best, you set it aside and you know that's my planting stock. So in my farm, I have, you know, that's one of the first things I do when I start cleaning my garlic is I'm separating my seed, and then I have my extra large, and then I have my large, and then I have my mediums, and then I have the little bits. And that's, I call that my bargain garlic. And it's just as delicious, but there are going to be little ones, you know. Not everything, even with best practices, are going to come out to be the biggest and the best. It's also important to, once you pull it out of the ground, you cure it, and then it will store longer for you. And it takes 2 to 3 weeks to cure garlic. And if you don't cure it, I mean, you're welcome to eat it the very day you pick it. Or you can pick it on into the season. Some people even eat garlic greens. But it's important to cure it so it will store for you so you can have fresh garlic all winter long.
And what do you do to cure it?
You dry it and 2 to 3 weeks in a 60, 70 degree temperature. In my situation, I put fans on it because I have such a high volume of garlic. I want good air circulation. But you would bundle it, 10 to 12 garlics per bunch, hang it in a warm, dry area and out of the sun, and just cure it for 2 to 3 weeks. It's so delicious. It's just rewarding. And it's worth a try, especially if you're a gardener.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Jenny. Good luck.
You can find Synergy Gardens on the web at synergygardens.net. They're also on Facebook. And Lori sells her products at her farm in Homer and at the Homer Farmers Market every Wednesday and Saturday, May 25th through September 28th. Up next, we'll visit with Garden Club board member Kathy Haas about seed starting.
I start my tomato plants, my pepper plants, like now. Within the next week, I'll be doing those. And I keep a journal and write down every time I start something, and then I can change it or, you know, alter it for the next year. So I think it's really important to keep notes on when you start stuff.
The seeds that you're starting, do you recommend folks get seeds from certain places or look for certain marks of quality in the seeds that they're getting?
I'm pretty fussy about what kind of tomatoes I grow. Pepper plants I'm not quite so fussy with, so I might take them off the rack. And just, it depends on certain things. If I try a variety and I don't like it, then I'll move on to the next one and I'll try different varieties that grow well for me, you know.
Probably another reason why it's important to keep a journal so you remember year to year.
Yep.
As far as where you're starting seeds, does it need to be warm? Does it need to be dry? Is a garage good? Does it need to be in the regular house where it's a little warmer?
You need about 70 degrees.
Okay.
to start them. I start them in my house. I have a shelving unit that I built myself, and I put shop lights with just regular fluorescent bulbs in it, and I grow them under there until it gets warm enough to move into my greenhouse.
So you've got some examples of those little black containers that we're all used to seeing. Do you have to use those? Can you use other containers? Can you do it kind of on the cheap?
You can do it on the cheap. Yogurt containers make great ones. If you have bigger plants, you can, you know, cottage cheese plant things. You don't have to buy the fancy trays and domes. A lot of the times you buy bakery items that come with a dome. Clean them out, use them up. You can plant in there and put a cover on them to start them. And yeah, and I also use meat trays. Meat trays work good for, you know, more room to put plants so they don't leak all over.
Do you need to poke holes in the bottom to keep them from getting overwatered, or just be careful when you're watering them?
If you're going to use like a yogurt container, you'd want to put holes in the bottom before you start it. Yeah.
And then watering, does that vary by plant as well, or you just kind of stick a finger in? If it's dry, you make sure it's not dry?
Yep, that's basically I do. You know, you don't want to overwater, and if you, I do the lift test. If it lifts up really, you know, light, it probably needs water.
Okay.
Yeah. Just judgment.
Do you have to worry about them getting, say you start something in a pretty small container, do you have to keep an eye and make sure it's not overgrowing where you're starting it? Do you ever need to upsize, or you just kind of plan ahead?
You transplant a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, tomato plants, I'll start them in a 1-inch pot, 1-inch square, and then I'll probably put it in a 4-inch pot later, and then into a 6-inch, and then finally when I'm ready for its final home, it'll be in a great big pot in my greenhouse.
So you're moving most of your stuff to your greenhouse. Do you ever start things inside that go straight outside, or do you have to worry about like hardening things at all, getting them ready to be out in different elements?
Well, you're supposed to harden them. I have a heated greenhouse, and then I have a greenhouse that's not heated, and I have a covered area that doesn't have walls on it, but it's covered. So what I do is when I get ready to getting close to going outside, I'll move them into the unheated greenhouse, which adds extra protection. Then I put them in the covered area, but they're still outside, but no, you know, still have a little bit more protection, and then they finally go out. So I don't do the actual hardening thing. I have my own method.
Okay. Whatever works for you, again, with the journal, keep track of what's successful and what isn't. Are there types of plants that you would recommend really need to be started inside versus seeds in the ground, hoping for the best? Or do you think everything should be started inside?
If you've got room, I would start as much as you can inside. It makes your vegetables edible faster.
Okay.
So if you do you can do kale outside, you can do lettuce outside, start it from seed. But if you give it a couple weeks extra inside, you'll be eating it a couple weeks earlier. So if you got the room and the time, I'd start everything you could inside.
How much time-wise or frequency-wise attention do your starts? Can you go on a week vacation and they'll be fine when you get back, or do you need to find somebody to come water your starts for you?
I wouldn't recommend leaving for a week. I don't go anywhere when I start plants because they're my babies, so I don't know. You'd have to find somebody to come in and water.
Time commitment. Okay.
Yep.
Are there any other tips or things that you think would be useful for folks to know if they're giving this a whirl for the first time?
Well, I use the potting mix over at Trinity Greenhouse for starting my seeds in, and it works very well, and I've talked to several people today that have used the same one, and we all agree that it works really good for us starting plants. It has a little fertilizer in it, so when the plants get a little big, they still have a source of food, so you don't have to transplant them right away. So,
and once you use that dirt once to start seeds, is that done, or can you reuse? Can you get like more than one start out of a?
Well, most of the time when I transplant it out, or if I transplant it into something bigger, the soil goes right with it. So, yeah, so it doesn't get reused that way. I would just recommend that if you're really serious about growing a nice garden, is take notes. Keep notes on everything you do, and then next year when you do it, you can improve on it. Yeah.
Marie McConnell came to the roundtables from Sterling. She found lots of useful information to get her started, or, well, restarted in gardening.
Came out to learn some more. I always learn something great at every garden club meeting event that I can apply. Yeah.
Do you have anything in particular that you were hoping to ask about or learn about today, or just whatever they're willing to tell you you're willing to soak up?
I was just wanting to see what they had. That, like I said, there's always something interesting, so I always learn something unexpected that I didn't know about before.
So what have you picked up today so far that you think is going to be useful?
I spent a lot of time over at Dennis's table, Dennis Spindler, and he has a whole bunch of perennials. Mm-hmm. And looking through those, I saw some things that I didn't know that were perennials, and so I'm hoping to maybe try some of those in my garden this summer or next year.
How long have you been gardening for in this area?
Well, I had first moved to Alaska in 94, and I planted a bunch of stuff in pots and didn't have any luck. Had all these green tomatoes in September, right when it was going to freeze, brought them in the house, and I had some that turned red. And I decided I was done gardening. I was just going to go ahead and support local farmers at farmers markets, buy stuff at the grocery store, because it wasn't like where I grew up in Montana with my mom and my grandma's gardens. So I finally was going through some stuff last year and found some seeds, and I thought, well, I'll just play around and see if these seeds will still grow. I had seeds that were like 15, you know, 20 years old.
Oh, dang.
And I actually had quite a few seeds that came back. Like radishes did really good, and I had cilantro seeds that, you know, were packaged for the late 90s. So I had fun with that, and they did well. So I kind of got encouraged that I'm learning that it's really important to have the right kind of soil, the right kind of lighting. I'm starting them at the right time, the right size of pots and stuff like that. So I guess I'm just recently interested in starting back up again.
What are your aspirations for this year? What are you hoping to grow?
I'd actually really, really love to have some good tomatoes and some good zucchinis, because those need greenhouses. So hopefully we can get the Sterling Community Center greenhouse going and have some of that. It didn't get used last year, and a couple of the panels that were up at the top, there was an issue with how the seal was, and so they came apart. And so I went to a meeting there last month, and some other people expressed interest in it too, so we're going to hopefully get a group of people together that give it a little bit of TLC and get it going again, and maybe we can make it where there's a market now on Fridays out at the Sterling Community Center in the summer, so maybe we could do something like 10% of what we make we could sell, and maybe kind of help it be self-supporting, so it would be a win-win.
We'll drop by a couple more roundtable stations in next month's show. Coming up next, we're going to check in on the Food Policy Council, which met in Homer earlier this month. We'll be right back.
Shaylin Cochran here, reporter and host at KDLL. You know, one of the things I like most about public radio is the time we get just to learn, explore, and talk. Join us Wednesday mornings at 10 a.m. to be a part of the Kenai Conversation, 60 minutes dedicated to learning, exploring, and talking right here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna, public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula.
This is Kenai Garden Talk on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman. Growing a food community is about much more than just growing food. It's forming connections, infrastructure, markets, and support among the producers, consumers, organizers, and lawmakers who all helped the local food movement grow in Alaska. The Alaska Food Festival and Conference does just that, connecting the Alaska Food Policy Council and the Alaska Farmers Market Association. The conference took place in Homer, March 8th and 9th. Here's Heidi Che, District Manager for the Kenai Soil and Water Conservation District.
It was a pretty incredible conference. This is the fourth time that there's been an Alaska food conference and festival like this, but it's the first time it's been on the peninsula and the first time that the brand new Alaska Farmers Market Association was a co-partner. We were out at Land's End. There were 200 people, two full days of presentations and good food and cooking and food preservation demonstrations and all kinds of good stuff. Takeaways for me is there is so much good, positive energy for developing strong local food systems all over the state. Many inspiring stories of small businesses getting started and being successful, school programs getting started and being successful, more use of traditional foods in hospital settings and senior homes all over the state and small villages, because Alaska leads the way in law that makes food donations of traditional foods possible. So that was cool. And there was a lot of talk about the governor's budget and what impact that will have on the Division of Agriculture, but I'd say overall, not so much hand-wringing as a real strong feeling of unity that we need to work together to continue to build this incredible momentum that we have going behind local food.
Governor Dunleavy's budget proposes eliminating the $1.2 million currently going to the Alaska Division of Agriculture. What effects do you think that cut would have?
Statewide, you know, the Division of Ag, some important pieces that we would expect to lose are a lot of the research capacity that goes on at the Alaska Plant Materials Center that benefits producers all over the state. That's where they produce the seed potatoes. We have seed potato growers here on the peninsula. That's where they do the research on peony crop and peony pests. And we have more peony growers here on the peninsula than in most of the other areas of the state. The Alaska Grown Marketing Fund is scheduled to be cut, and that's something that benefits all small producers all over the state. The Revolving Loan Fund would be eliminated. That's something that our small producers here on the peninsula don't take advantage of to a great extent, nor do we have dairies that need to be inspected. But other things that would directly impact us here on the peninsula are things like the Specialty Crop Block Grant, which is a block of federal funds that come to the state through the Division of Agriculture each year. And through a competitive process, farms and community organizations and nonprofit entities can apply for those funds to do projects that help grow the local food system. So, for instance, right now at Oceanside Farms in Homer, there's a rhubarb processing project, and they're pioneering new ways to use rhubarb. And in recompense, they're sharing what they learn with rhubarb growers all over the state and making equipment available to folks here on the Kenai Peninsula. Another example is Kenai Soil and Water Conservation District have used that kind of funding source to put on farmers and chefs gatherings and farmers market trainings and other events that help build the local food system. So without the Division of Ag to receive and manage those funds, I'm afraid that all of that will go away. But even bigger than that, Senator Murkowski has announced this several times, so I hope people are aware that she secured in the Farm Bill $4 million a year for what she's calling food security mini-grants. And these would be grants of $5,000 to $15,000 that could go to individuals, villages, communities, nonprofit organizations to do very tangible projects to increase food security. With, again, these are funds that have to go to the Division of Ag or a state entity in order to be distributed. And when you're distributing mini grants, it really takes a lot of staff supervision to make sure that those funds are put to good use. So I'm afraid that would be something that might also go away.
On a happier note, there were some awards given out at the conference. The Food Heroes Award recognizes people who have had a substantial impact on Alaska's food system. Who were the winners this year?
Well, they handed out three awards this year, and the first one went to food producers, Tim and Lisa Myers of Myers Farm in Bethel. They are very pioneering and innovative out there, producing literally tons of food for Bethel and shipping it to other parts of the state. The second one went to a small business owner, Leah Heifetz, in Southeast, and she started Barnacle Foods. They turn kelp into salsa and all sorts of other interesting products, and she's developed a successful business with her partner there. And then the third one went to a local food fan and promoter, and that would be myself.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry to make you announce that for yourself, but it's very well deserved.
What I'd like to say about that is that I accepted that award on behalf of all the folks I work with at Kenai Local Food Connection. They're all volunteers, and the folks I work with on my Kenai Soil and Water Board who are volunteers, and the farmers markets who have been very great to work with. And we have a bunch of folks in this community that are pulling together to make local food happen. It's really interesting that each time this award, Alaska Food Hero, has been given out at one of these Alaska food conferences, every time it's gone to somebody in the Kenai Peninsula borough. The first one went to Tyonek Tribal Conservation District for their community garden that involves lots of tribal youth and sells product in Anchorage. The next, and it also went to Kyra Wagner, who has been a huge farmers market promoter in Homer and really is almost single-handedly behind the high tunnel boom that we have here on the Kenai Peninsula. And another one went to Robbie Mixon in Homer, and she's the one who started the Alaska Food Hub and the Alaska Farmers Market Association. So the fact that so many of these are coming to the Kenai Peninsula is kind of neat, and there's state recognition that we've got a lot going on here. In fact, I was at Everything Bagels the other day for a delicious brunch, and I had the most beautiful bagel I've ever seen with fresh microgreens from the new hydroponic farm in Soldotna on those locally made bagels. And that's just a very happy sign of how our food system is growing and small businesses are starting and connecting with each other. And we're developing that positive reinforcing loop that makes local food system happen.
Wait, did she say hydroponics farm producing year-round greens in Soldotna? She did indeed. We'll take a tour right after this.
Every year is a good year for jazz. Whether it's the Duke or Ella or someone newer to the scene, you'll find all your jazz favorites on A Good Year for Jazz with your host, Nathan. Each week, travel the calendar back to 1945, 59, or even 2015 to hear what was happening in the world of jazz. I'll meet you right here Monday nights 7 to 9 on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
This is Kenai Garden Talk on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman. The shoulder season between winter and spring is usually the doldrums for fresh food lovers on the Kenai Peninsula. You've used up all the garden fresh veggies from the summer, and it'll be a couple months yet before gardens are producing again. What is a fresh foodie to do? Well, there's a new option in Soldotna, and it's got a bright future.
Yeah, it gets very difficult to work when the lights are on because it's so bright.
Needing sunglasses indoors in Alaska in the middle of winter is a bit of a downside, I guess, to container hydroponic gardening. But the upshot of running high-efficiency LED lighting 18 hours a day are seeds that germinate in 2 days and greens ready for harvest in just 8 days. And that's happening 365 days a year at Fresh 365 on Whistle Hill in Soldotna. The fully contained computerized hydroponic farm was started this summer by Soldotna doctor Henry Krull to provide fresh produce for the family's new Addy Camp restaurant, as well as for sale to the public and for their own consumption.
The idea to start doing it was really my own personal desire to have something better than what we can get in stores locally, primarily during the off season. The summertime, a lot of people have gardens. I'm kind of an avid gardener, but with that first frost, everything dies and then you're back to store-bought, which is just not appealing. As we started to get closer to opening of the restaurant, it became more clear to me that we needed to do something on a bigger scale so that we could supply the restaurant with produce year-round. So I looked online, and this company called Modular Farms that built this unit came up as kind of a turnkey operation that I didn't really have to design or engineer. So it made it very simple. So that was the primary driver, but my own selfish needs was part of it too.
And how long have you been dealing with hydroponics? Is this your first go around with this, or did you have a setup at home or done it somewhere else before?
No, I've never done it before. So I've grown in soil up through this summer. And then my hydroponic experience started in this summer in about August when we did training for the farm here.
And what made you interested in hydroponics? I think a lot of folks around here are going the high tunnel route, which extends the season anyway. It certainly doesn't get you year-round. Was this kind of the year-round approach? Is that the appeal of doing it this way?
Yeah, it seemed like the only way really to do it was hydroponics indoors rather than trying to do a high tunnel or a greenhouse and heat that year-round. and still have to provide lights, and it's a little bit less controlled environment. This container farming is it's a much smaller footprint, and you don't have to worry so much. It's insulated, so you don't have to worry about weather so much. So it just made sense to do it inside a container.
The unit is 40 feet by 10 feet by 10 feet and looks from the outside deceivingly like the ubiquitous Alaska Connex trailer, albeit a spiffy, nicely painted one. Inside, though, is a literal breath of fresh 75-degree air, even on a March afternoon where it was barely above freezing outside.
We're growing mostly greens, lettuces, greens like kale and arugula, and herbs. This is our seedling area. So we use regular seeds, kind of like you'd put in soil, and we stick them into peat plugs, which are these little things here, and fill the tray up with peat plugs and seeds, and germinate it down on the lower rack, which is the dry rack. And once things germinate, which normally takes 2 or 3 days to get germination, they get moved up into the wet rack. So the two racks up here are the wet racks, and they get watered 3 times a day for about 5 minutes. So they get soaked in water, the plugs get wet, the seeds get wet, and the growth continues underneath the LED lights that are in there as well.
Okay, and what all do you have germinating in there right now?
So we have microgreens, which have been very popular and delicious. We've got 6 trays going at a time of microgreens, and they take about 8 to 9 days to get to full maturity. So seeds to harvest, about 8 to 9 days.
That is insane for Alaska.
Yeah, it's insane anywhere. And then up here we've got bok choy, arugula, and then a whole variety of lettuces, red leaf lettuce, Salanova butterhead lettuce. We've got some fennel and radicchio in here also. And so these are the newer seedlings, and then these ones are just 2 or 3 days old. So March 1st, it's 4 days. That's what they look like. We've got some more mature microgreens, and then we've got 2 trays of microgreens we just seeded. So
when they get mature enough, do they go down in the next section there?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So when they get mature in the seedling area, which these really are ready to go.
And these are a couple inches tall, most
yeah,
of them romaine lettuces.
And when they get a root structure, they're ready to transplant, so.
Oh, so the plugs just pop right out of there.
Yeah. So these are 11 days old.
Wow, and that's
a good root structure.
2 inches tall or so about for lettuce?
Yeah. Once they develop a root structure, they can go into the vertical towers. Probably one of the newest ones here. The vertical towers have a nylon grow medium inside, and so the plugs go directly into this nylon grow medium, and the roots are, or the root ball is in contact with a wicking strip inside here, which is a strip of felt that basically collects the water, concentrates it, and brings it right to the roots. So these are all on drip emitters, which you can see up above, and every 15 minutes they get dripped for 4 minutes.
What kind of fertilizer, or what's in the water that's feeding them?
So the water is at what we call a fertigation solution. It's the water and also the nutrients. So the nutrients are added to the water and stored in tanks on the other side of the table. And that's what gets pumped through the system and then pumped back into the tanks for reuse. So all of the fertigation water is reused. Everything basically inside here is reused, including the air. The air is conditioned. The humidity is taken out with the dehumidifiers. The water from the dehumidifiers then goes back into the tank and returns the water. So all the water is recycled. We use about probably 10 gallons of water per week to grow inside the farm. And if we were outdoors, we'd probably use between 100 and 500 gallons a week. So a tremendous amount of water savings growing indoors. But the air gets conditioned also, the moisture is removed, CO2 is added to the air. The plants are very, very good at making oxygen, but if you have too much oxygen, the plants die. So we have to add CO2 to also keep the plants growing. So we've got a tank that pumps it in. Everything's computer controlled. The CO2, the oxygen levels, the moisture, the temperature, humidity, everything's controlled by computer with sensors and automatically adjusted. The fertigation solution is also controlled for temperature, pH and nutrient content.
So this is nerd gardening then, basically?
Yeah, it is. This would be very hard to do without the computer controls. You'd have to take hand measurements of things many, many times a day. It would be next to impossible, really, to do. When you grow in soil, you can add nutrients to it, and they leach into the soil over a period of days and weeks. Here, it's just in water, and plants get watered, and so you have to control the concentration of the nutrients and the pH that's in the water that bathes the plants every 15 minutes of every day.
Yeah, with soil gardening, not only does it take longer for the nutrients to get to the plants and for the plants to uptake them, but I would imagine if your ratios are off, if you have too much fertilizer or not enough, it probably takes longer to know that as well.
Exactly.
I would imagine with this, you have a pretty immediate response and can tell early if there's something's a little off.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the fact that we're able to control things very carefully and keep them within certain parameters, we can maximize the growth of the plants too. And that's what allows us to take lettuce seeds, for instance, and grow them to full heads of lettuce in about 6 weeks. So that's what we've got further on down here. These lettuces are almost ready for harvest. They're probably 5 or 6 weeks old. And we've got various stages of things. Here's some arugula that's probably 3 weeks old, some radicchio, more lettuces, and then thyme down at the end. This is our kale wall over here. This is all kale. This stuff's about 5 months old. The stalks are, we've cut most of the long ones, but some of the stalks are about 4 feet long, growing up into the ceiling, and we have to replant them because we can't access them anymore.
It looks like maybe you're harvesting off the lower part of the stalk and then just let the plant kind of do its thing until it's tapped out.
Yeah, the kale we do what's called, and the herbs we do cut and come again, which means you cut what you need and let the rest of it grow.
Yeah, some of that stuff, the longer you leave it, the tougher it gets. So being able to get to it when it's still tender and young is probably...
Yeah, the kale doesn't seem to matter. It's all, if you grow it in the garden, it does get tough. And when it gets the first frost, of course, it starts to go bad. But these plants are five, almost 6 months old, and the leaves are as tender as anything you can find. So the quality of the produce is unparalleled. It's just you can't get it any better.
And it's interesting for vertical gardening, too. I would think the leaves would be more flopping over and reaching out and shaped weird. But these are, I mean, they might as well be horizontal. They're just nice, tidy little lettuce heads, just you'd expect growing on flat ground.
Yeah, we were surprised with the kale in particular when we went to visit a farm in Toronto. Their kale grows horizontally. Ours goes more vertical. I don't know if that's the difference between Canada and the U.S., but... It was kind of interesting to find that out.
Maybe theirs tastes a little bit like maple, too. You never know.
It might.
So what was the learning curve like getting all this set up? Did your first crop just go great, or did you have some kind of disasters to work yourself through?
We've had a few little disasters, but nothing that's threatened the crop overall. We had some sensor problems and ended up dumping about a week's worth of nutrient into our tank. And basically, we irrigated our plants with what would be considered poison, not poison harmful, but because the pH was very low, it was very acidic, and should have killed everything, and it didn't. The plants didn't even hardly notice it.
Oh, wow.
But we fixed the sensor problem, got on top of that within a matter of hours, so it wasn't a catastrophic loss. But overall, the learning curve has been fairly short. Again, with the computer controls, it's basically the computer monitors and adjusts things, and we basically monitor the computer to make sure that everything's being read properly and being corrected properly. So it was fairly simple. We went to a 2-day or a 3-day training course in Toronto where they kind of taught us how to farm hydroponically, and that was very, very helpful. We would have had a very difficult time without doing that. But for someone who's gardened in soil, the transition is not terribly difficult.
What kind of output, I don't know how you quantify that, but how productive has this been?
How productive? Well, if we were to grow just heads of lettuce in here, we can grow about 4,000 heads of lettuce at a time, and we would produce about 1,000 heads per week.
That's a lot of math. That's a lot of lettuce.
That's a lot of lettuce. Yeah. Lettuce is about probably almost 50% of our crop because it's the most popular thing. The greens and the herbs make up the rest of that. But we have 200 to 300, we sell about 200 to 300 heads of lettuce every week.
Oh,
The restaurant's using about 50% now. About a third of it goes to public sale, and then we sell the remaining quarter or so to other restaurants and cafes in the area.
And you still get some for your own home family use?
Unlimited. That's the best part about it. And it has flavor, and it has texture, and it lasts in the refrigerator. And it's just, again, for people that garden in the summer, everybody knows it does that, how good it is in the summertime. And fortunately, we have that year-round now.
Yeah, it's March outside, and to walk in here, it smells and feels like June, July at least.
Right, yeah. Well, it's kind of like going to Florida. It's 75 and sunny all the time, and it's just like that in here.
Pests are probably not much of an issue in a controlled space like this either. Do you have to worry about mold at all or anything like that, or is that all pretty well contained?
Yeah, I think mold is a potential issue just because it's a contained environment, and we have good airflow. We've got fans, and we've got HVAC systems that pump air through here, but any place you get stagnant air, such as if you get overgrowth in a certain plant or a certain crop, mold can be an issue, and we're on the lookout for it all the time. You can get other pests like gnats that are fruit flies, things like that, that you sometimes see inside your home as well and hovering around food, particularly in the wintertime. And we've had a few of those in here that have not, posed a threat or a hazard or anything, but irritating little things. Our biggest problem is probably algae. And you get algae anytime you get warm and a lot of light. And there's a lot of light and a lot of warmth and humidity in here too. So we use peroxide to help control our algae, and peroxide is food safe and not harmful and not really a chemical per se, but it's helped to keep that at bay. But most pests that affect greenhouses and gardens, we just don't see here.
So this is not without its challenges, but just looking around, I don't see a single leaf that looks at all like it's yellowed or it's shriveling.
Yeah, there's there's some occasional struggles, and we get yellow leaves, and we do have to do pruning and remove dead leaves that just die from lack of sunlight, primarily stuff that gets hidden behind the canopy. It requires some attention, but if you put forth the effort and do the pruning that you need to do, you keep everything healthy and you keep pests away. So it all works out.
So even hydroponics is not effort-free. There's probably no level of gardening that you're not out tending some hours of the day.
That is correct. There's always something to do in here, and if you don't give it the attention that it needs, you'll have problems. So we try to stay on top of them.
Fresh 365 is open for public sales on Whistle Hill from 1 to 4 p.m. Thursdays and 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturdays.
I think they enjoy coming here because they can see how it's grown and they can watch it being harvested immediately. We literally take an order and someone watches us come to the farm wall and pick a head of lettuce right off the farm wall, so they see exactly where it's coming from. And it's not to say that things are a whole lot different at farmers market, but I think there's a appeal and desire to see it in action, and people really appreciate that. One of the messages that we're trying to get out to people that we talk to and people that come in and people that appreciate what we're doing is we're trying to spur some further interest in doing this in the community. Because really the community, there is potential for the community to supply the community with fresh produce. And so I want to encourage others who think that this might be possible to look into doing it so that we can make this a community-wide effort rather than just one guy trying to do what he can do. I've got another job, so I've got other things to do besides farming, even though I love doing this. But if we had two or three other farms like this, we could literally supply the whole community with fresh greens year-round. And that's really my biggest goal, is to try to get this to be a sustainable effort for the whole community. And eventually, expand and make it the whole peninsula and the whole state and outlying communities and bush communities. You stick one of these in Bethel or something, there's no reason it can't operate there. And all of a sudden, Bethel has a fresh supply of greens.
Thanks again to Henry Kroll for the garden tour. Coming up, we'll take a look at the gardening calendar for the next month, so stay tuned.
Have you ever wondered how much fish we sell on the Kenai, or how much oil comes from here, what it's all worth, and what it all means? Well, we have too. That's why we created Econ 919, a weekly look at the Kenai Peninsula's economy, what makes it work, and who makes it work. Tune in each Friday at 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. for new numbers, emerging trends, and a bit of trivia. Econ 919, Friday mornings at 9 and again at 5, right here on KDLL, Public Radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula.
Thanks for joining Kenai Garden Talk for March 16th, 2019 on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. We'll be back at 11 a.m. the third Saturday of April. In the meantime, here's what's happening in the local food scene. The Soldotna Library has a Gardening for Procrastinators class with Casey Matney from the Cooperative Extension Service at 2 p.m. today. Learn how to get a small-scale garden started indoors. For anyone thinking about selling at a farmer's market this season, now's the time to start an application. You can find information on all the local markets at kenaisoilandwater.org. On March 26th, there's a QuickBooks Online class for ag producers from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Kenai Peninsula College. It's free for agricultural producers with an Alaska business license. Sign up through the Small Business Development Center at aksbdc.ecenterdirect.com. March 29th is the deadline to submit proposals to use the Kenai Soil and Water Conservation District's DEC-approved mobile kitchen trailer for use in preparing or serving food at events or preparing value-added food products. Email kenaiswcd@gmail.com for more information. Alaska Food Hub information and vendor training is coming up April 10th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association building on K Beach Road. The Alaska Food Hub is an online farmer's market with distribution points in Soldotna, Homer, and Seldovia. For more information, visit alaskafoodhub.org. The Central Peninsula Garden Club has its next meeting at 7 p.m. April 10th at Peninsula Grace Brethren Church on Kalifornsky Beach Road. The topic is everything you need to know about starting seeds for your garden. You do not need to be a member to attend, although there are some members-only events coming up this season. Find out more about the club at senpengardenclub.com. On April 17th, there's a Keep Alaska Wild Invasive Species Workshop from 3 to 7 p.m. at the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association. Learn how to prevent the spread of invasive species. It's a free workshop put on by the Kenai Peninsula Cooperative Weed Management Area. Details at kenaiweeds.org. The next monthly Kenai Local Food Connection meeting will be at 6:30 p.m. April 18th at the Kenai Peninsula College Library in Soldotna. It's a grassroots effort to grow the local food movement, and it's open to the public. And finally, Farm and Food Friday is held the third Friday of every month. The next meeting is April 19th from 8:30 to 9:30 a.m. at Odie's Deli in Soldotna. It's an informal opportunity to connect with fellow farmers and farm-supporting organizations. For more information, call Heidi Che at 283-8732, extension 5. And that'll do it for this month's Kenai Garden Talk. We'll leave with a quote from Gertrude Jekyll. "The love of gardening is a seed once sown that never dies." Thanks for tuning in.